So we have introduced basically all the machinery that regulates transcription so far. We still have to talk about the distal regulatory elements. We haven't talked about enhancers yet, so today we'll discuss about enhancer. But before doing that, I want to spend a little time discussing the dynamics of transcription factor and cofactor recruitment, just to conclude the topic that we discussed this morning. And then after that, we'll move to talk about enhancer and what the enhancers are and how they are regulated. So the reason for talking a little more about transcription factor and cofactor is that I believe that because of the way in which we discuss about them and because of the way in which transcription factor and cofactor have been studied, you may have formed a pretty static impression of how these factors interact with DNA and how they work. And so the way in which we have presented them and the way in which we have studied them led us to design this kind of models where there is a transcription factor that is either bound or unbound to DNA, and then these interact with different machinery, it interacts with corepressor, and then there is an exchange for the coactivator. Those corepressor and coactivators can interact with the pre-initiation complex. And this gives the idea that that these are pretty static processes where these things either are bound or they are not bound, and once they bound for a long time and they drive transcription or regulation. Now, this is probably not the reality. It's much more of a dynamic process. And so I think this is something that it has to be kept in mind as we talk about transcriptional regulation. We tend to describe things in hierarchical models where one thing binds first and then another thing comes later, because that helps us to understand how they work. However, when they happen in nature, they happen very fast, and things keep moving and protein keep interacting on and off DNA. And this, if you remember the movie that we saw a couple of days ago, even the process of peak interaction with DNA and RNA polymerase activation is extremely fast one. And so we are not talking about transcription factor or coactivators that bind to DNA and then they stay there for hours and manage to regulate transcription for a long time, but we are talking about pretty fast events. And so one thing that I would like to do before we leave this argument is to show you some of the work that has been done to reach this conclusion and to understand whether these are dynamics or they are static type of events. This is a good review that, if you are interested in this topic, can be a good reference article. Gordon Hager is probably one of the person that has done most of the work about dynamics of transcription factor interactions with DNA. And he has the very extreme view. He presents a very extreme view that everything is extremely stochastic, happening extremely fast. But he has opened an interesting area of investigation where many different labs have started to look at the dynamics of transcription factor DNA interaction. And the picture that has emerged is one where the old transcriptional regulation is extremely dynamic. And so we have to study the very short-term binding dynamics of transcription factor to really understand the long-term events and the effect on the output of transcription. Now, one of the first studies that indicated that transcription factor binding to DNA is extremely fast. this first. Okay. So the first thing that he discussed in the review is how transcription factor finder targets. And this, if you think about it, it's an interesting problem, because when we discussed transcription factor this morning, we discussed about what they are and what are their binding site and the fact that they can bind specifically in a sequence-specific manner. But you have to think about the fact that all these things happen within the nucleus. And so each of the transcription factor binding site is present in a limiting number in the genome. And so if you think about it, there are some, I think they assume that the promoter region makes less than 1% of the human genome. And many transcription factors have few binding sites. The nucleus is big. There are a lot of things happening. There is chromatin organization. There are a lot of proteins there. And so the question is, how is this single transcription factor, or the many molecule of it, move around and find its target? It doesn't have a GPS that tells him, okay, you have to go right, left, and then you find your transcription factor binding site. And so this is one of the type of question that led people to start to study really the dynamics of movement of proteins within the nucleus. And so the model that they propose is one where the transcription factor find their specific binding site by a random scanning. So one of the properties of transcription factor as other proteins is that they can diffuse to the nucleus. So by diffusing to the nucleus, they are exposed to potential interaction with the different region of the genome all the time. And so there is this hit and run type of model where they keep moving around and they hit the DNA. They may find sequences that they cannot interact at all with, and so they immediately detach. They can find regions where there is a sequence that corresponds to their favored binding site. And so those are the cases in which you have binding of the transcription factor to DNA. But the question is, even when they find a specific binding, then what happens? Do they stay bound here for a long time, or they keep bouncing on and off and then looking for the same or another place to bind? And so this is the type of studies that people like Gordon Hager and McNally, who was in his lab, have been doing in the last 10 years or so. This was the first study that was published. I think it was at the beginning of 2000, probably. And what they did was to take advantage of a modified cell line in which there was there had been integration of a large tandem array of the MMTV virus in the genome. So the MMTV virus is bound by the LTR region of the MMTV virus is bound by the glucocorticoid receptor. And so they use this model as a way to investigate the binding of glucocorticoid receptor to DNA. The reason why they had to use this system is because they wanted to use imaging approaches to be able to really visualize the binding in real time. And so the fact that the array contains multiple copies of the MMTV virus make it for a system where there are multiple molecules of the glucocorticoid receptor that binds to the same region. And so there is, I think, up to 400 molecules that can bind at the same time. And so this means that you have a cluster of binding, and then it makes it easier to visualize it by imaging technique rather than being able to detect a single molecule. So in order to visualize this, they used probes that label the MMTV virus, as well as they overexpressed, I think they say it up here, they overexpressed glucocorticoid receptor labeled by GFP. And so by doing imaging of the GFP, they were in an inducible manner. By doing imaging of the GFP, they were able to look at GFP where it would be binding, so where the binding of all the glucocorticoid receptor, in this case on the MMTV promoter, LTR. But they were also able to use the imaging of the protein and the DNA at the same time to do FRAP experiment. And so by doing a bleaching experiment and then looking at how fast they had the recovery of the interaction between the two elements. They were able to look at how fast the protein would bind to DNA, as well as by doing the opposite, they were able to see how fast it would detach. And so they did a number of analyses in this paper where they look at the dynamics of interaction between glucocorticoid receptor and this MMTV ILTR. And the range of binding that they find is in the range of seconds. So by 4 seconds, this is already completely reassembled. Now, if you read the literature from this paper until now, after that, these kind of studies have been done with other transcription factor, with other systems, and there is some discrepancy in the results in terms of how fast these kinetics are. There are papers that report kinetics that are as short as milliseconds. So residence of the receptor on the DNA that is shorter than milliseconds. There are other papers where they argue that this is not, that those are results that are altered by intrinsic limitation of the imaging system that is used to record them, as well as that some of these assays are done on very artificial conditions where you have these large arrays of binding site, and so that they don't represent the in vivo situation. Anyway, taking in consideration all these, I'm not an expert in the field, so I'm not taking a stand neither in one direction or the other, I'm just presenting you the literature. But the main concept I think that we can take from this study is that the dynamics of interaction are very fast. There may be milliseconds or they may be 100 seconds, as some other people say, but they're still extremely fast. So we are not talking about transcription factor that bind to DNA and then stay bound for hours at the time. Okay? Another approach that has been used to look at this kind of dynamic regulation of gene transcription was the analysis of estrogen receptor bound to its in vivo binding site by CHIP. And so this is a study that is pretty well known. It's the first example of a group attempting a very huge task, which is the task of looking by hand chip, because at that time ChIP-seq was not available yet, looking by hand chip, so at a single promoter, at the binding of a number of proteins in real time by doing chip every 5 minutes. So you'll see the data, they have collected a huge number of time points. They have, I don't know how many chips they have been doing and how many PCRs have been doing in order to be able to draw this kind of map. But it's an interesting study because now we are not talking about artificial systems. There is not the limitation of the imaging approaches. They are looking at the kinetics of the binding in vivo on the real promoter. And so the system they use is breast cancer cells, MCF7 cells. These are cells that respond well to estrogen stimulation. And they look at the binding of estrogen receptor to one of its most characterized target gene, which is called PS2 or PS2 gene promoter. So this is, in a way, an ideal situation because the estrogen receptor chip works extremely well, and this gene is very well characterized in terms of recruitment of the estrogen receptor. And so what they did was to take, trying to optimize the condition to be able to look at the kinetics. They took a number of different steps. The first one was to starve the cells from estrogen for several days. So they wanted to make sure that they were starting from a condition in which there was no estrogen at all, so that they could look at activation starting from a time zero. The second thing they did was to add alpha-manitin right before the experiments. So alpha-manitin, you may remember, it's an inhibitor of RNApoL2 transcription. So this is a way to block transcription and make sure that they synchronize the cells in the same situation. So then when they start the experiment, they remove alpha-manitin and start looking at the activation by estrogen receptor. All the cells are starting from the same situation, a situation where transcription is off and there is no estrogen, so that they don't have problems due to the fact that different cells are responding with different timings. Okay? And then they wash the cells and then start treating them with estradiol estrogen. And so doing it this way, they have a time zero, and then after that they monitor by chip estrogen receptor as well as other factors at 5 minutes interval on the PS2 promoter. And the result that they observe are extremely interesting. So if you look at the graph, here is the time of the chip. So they have, as I said, they start probing every 5 minutes, and then they represent it as percentage of input. In this particular case, they are probing for estrogen receptor and polymerase II. And what they see is that as time goes, they have a first small peak of estrogen receptor recruitment within a few minutes, and then it gets dismissed. And then after that, they start to recruit again estrogen receptor together with RNA polymerase II. But it seems again a cyclical recruitment where estrogen receptor gets recruited, stays on DNA for about 20 minutes, and then is dismissed. And the interesting thing is that RNA polymerase seems to have the same type of cyclical pattern. It's just shifted a little bit. And so it looks like there is also a hierarchical recruitment in terms of when Pol2 start to work on this promoter after the recruitment of the transcription factor. And then after that, you keep going with very similar cycles that keep going with a phase of about 20 minutes. As I said, in order to get all these time points, it took them a lot of work, but this type of detailed analysis allowed them to see a cyclicity that other people had not been able to observe before. Because if you are doing the chip after 1 hour of treatment, as we were doing before, what you see is 0 and 1 hour, you see no recruitment, yes recruitment. And those are the type of experiment that led to those static pictures that we saw before, where you say, okay, there is no transcription factor first, then it gets recruited, then you look at Pol2 and you say Pol2 also is recruited, and so on and so forth. Whereas this type of experiment shows that things keep cycling on and off the promoter. Now, the effort was even greater than this, because they have done the same type of experiment for a huge number of cofactor, co-activator, co-repressor, so this is the plot that you saw before. Then they look at histone acetyl transferases. And if you compare the cycles that are induced by ER recruitment in black, you see that there are also cycles of acetyl transferases, P300, CBP, PCAF. And those are interesting again because they are right at the beginning of the cycle of estrogen receptor. So if you compare this with the Pol2, it suggests that at each of the cycles, the acetylation events precede the recruitment and the activation of Pol2. And I'm saying activation because they don't profile only Pol2 itself, but they also profile phosphorylated Pol2, so elongating Pol2. Okay. The other thing, they also profile some methyl transferases that have a positive role in transcriptional activation. And then they profile histones. And this also is interesting because histone modification. And so this is also interesting because it suggests that the modification itself are deposited and removed, deposited and removed. It's not that the histones are acetylated and then they stay acetylated for a long time. Even more, They also profiled things like the general transcriptional machinery, so the TF2A, TF2B, TBP recruitment. And TBP is the only one, together with TF2A, that seems to have a slightly different cycle. So it's not that it's stable, but it's not doesn't cycle each cycle. It seems to be stable for about two cycles, and it's not really clear what that means. They profile other TAFs, element component of the mediator complex. You can see that all of them show this cyclical pattern. Now, one interesting thing that I think it's also worth mentioning is the recruitment of the SWISNF complex. So SWISNF is an ATP-dependent chromatin remodeling complex that is that seems to be recruited at, in the middle between between cycles. And this, together with the fact that if you compare the recruitment of the of BRG1 and it's so these are two components of the SWISNF complex. If you compare it with the changes in nucleosome, suggests that at each of the cycles there is nucleosome remodeling and reorganization of the chromatin structure. Interestingly, later in a different paper later on, it was also shown that the corepressors are also recruited with a cyclical pattern, and just like BRG1, they are recruited in the middle between towards the end of the cycle. So this suggests that even the exchange of corepressor for coactivator, it's not something that happens once and for all at the beginning. But at each of the cycle, you keep having these complexes that go on and off the DNA. They could come with corepressor, with coactivator. So it's like you have a constant checkpoint where the gene is able to turn off transcription if the ligand is not there anymore. And it does so by continuing to remodel things. So one thing you may ask is how can we reconcile the very fast kinetics, the kinetics of seconds that have been observed for for transcription factor, with these cycles of about 20 minutes that have been observed by CHIP? And to be honest, the answer is still it's still not completely clear. But the argument that one could make is that if you look at the single molecule of each transcription factor, as you do when you do the imaging experiment, you have very fast kinetics of seconds. However, when you do CHIP, you are not chipping one single molecule. You are chipping across the cells on all the different alleles. Okay, and so what they what it's arguing in this review, and it it's a reasonable explanation, is that at each single time when you probe every 5 minutes, you are probing in a situation in which there is an increase or a decrease frequency of this fast exchange on DNA. But because you are measuring by CHIP the whole population at once, you can kind of like integrate all these things in one larger peak. And so you have a period of time where these things interact more often, and then a period of time where these things are less likely to interact on and off. This is an explanation. There may be others. I think the clear dynamics are not completely understood yet, but I think it's important to realize that these are not static events. They are pretty dynamic regulatory events. Okay, so with this we have finished the chapter on transcription factor and cofactors. So we have looked at all the different machineries that regulates transcription. As we said at the beginning, the complexity of transcriptional regulation is based on the combination of a complex machinery that can interact with the large variety of physical elements on the genome. We have looked at the promoters and the area where the core machinery binds. So we still have to consider all the distal regulatory sites. and so an answer and how they work and how they communicate with the promoter area. So today we'll discuss what an answer are and how they are selected, and then tomorrow we'll finish the an answer chapter by seeing how they work and how they regulate transcription by looping onto the promoter. So one thing to realize first is that even though the field of enhancer regulation has exploded in the recent past, the primary concept of how enhancer work and what they are have actually been known for quite a long time. And the initial studies on enhancer activity actually come from studies on Drosophila patterning in development. So this figure comes, I believe, from the review that you have as a textbook at the beginning of the course, the Michael Levine review about transcription. The idea is that during Drosophila development, there are different stages, obviously, of embryonic development and then adult development. One thing that is conserved across is that the patterning that then leads to the patterning of the body of the adult animal is established very early on during development. And it's established thanks to a pattern of transcription factor gradients that are present within the body of the embryo. This is due to mRNA that are deposited from the mother. So really the initial organization of the embryo is what lead to the establishment of this patterning. And so this has been very well studied for a long time. And these are some of those beautiful images that people have realized in by studying Drosophila, where you can see that there are this pattern of expression of different molecule, different protein within the embryo. Those are critical for the development of the adult Drosophila. And the interesting thing is that this is one example of probably the first and best who studied enhancer regulation is this gene, the even skipped gene. And because if you look at the locus of the of this gene, you can see that there are different regions, different regulatory elements that control the expression of this gene in the different stripes. And depending on whether the transcription factor that regulate those particular enhancer are present or absent, then you get this nice patterning profile. So this was a clear indication that transcription of this gene, of two things. First of all, the transcription of genes can be regulated by regulatory elements that are far away from the transcriptional star site. They can be either upstream or downstream. So second observation, there is not a positional effect in this case. And then the third thing is that the same gene can be regulated by multiple regulatory region in a different way in different locations. In this case, in the different part of the embryos. In other cases, it can be different tissues or the different cell types. Now, one thing that increased the complexity of transcriptional regulation in higher vertebrates is that the number of enhancer regions, so the number of this distal regulatory region, has dramatically increased. And so we go from situation in bacteria and early organism where most of the regulatory sequences are located right at the promoter level. So the only type of regulation present is the one that we discussed this morning, where you have the core promoter with a few regulatory regions that are right adjoining to the core promoter. Two situations where you start to see the appearance of distal regulatory region, and then the situation that is present in the higher organism where you have large number of enhancer that can be located in different positions. And this is one of the characteristics of enhancer. they can be located in different locations compared to the gene that they regulate. So you can have the most classical situation, which is probably the one we all think about when we draw an answer, where the enhancer is located in a very distal region upstream of the regulated gene. But there are also situations where the enhancer can be very close. And those were the cases that we discussed the other day when we talked about promoter, where it becomes difficult to discriminate between proximal distal promoters or proximal enhancer. The limitation between these two things becomes hard to define. But there is also the possibility that enhancers are located downstream of the regulated gene, just like in the case of the Drosophila gene we looked at, as well as there are many enhancers that are located within the sequence of the gene in intronic locations. There are also different ways in which this regulation can occur. There are cases like the one that we just looked at where there are multiple enhancers. Now, these are all drawn close to each other, but they don't need to be close to each other. So those are all different enhancers, like the one of the even-skip gene, where each of the enhancers regulate the gene in different conditions. They can be different tissues or different developmental stages. Or there can be situations where there are different enhancers that cooperate together and regulate one single gene, as well as a situation where one enhancer regulates more genes. And these can end up in different outputs. There can be situations where the enhancer regulates multiple genes that need to be expressed at the same time, and so it helps co-regulate those genes, as well as situation in which the enhancer regulates either one. And so the fact that one is regulated at a certain time excludes that the others are expressed. In terms of different enhancer regulating one single gene in a tissue-specific manner, like we saw in Drosophila, there is also the possibility that these enhancers are differentially used in pathological conditions. And so this is one example for the MYC gene. MYC is an oncogene, so it's highly upregulated in many different cancers. And one thing that is interesting is that it's not at the transcriptional level. MYC is upregulated in a million of different ways. But at the transcriptional level, it's not regulated by the same transcriptional mechanism in all the different cancer types. And so you can see here from this review that if you look at pancreatic cancer, for example, MYC is upregulated by an enhancer that is located downstream of the transcriptional star site. Whereas if you look at the colorectal cancer, this is upregulated through a different enhancer that is located upstream. Now, this is important because these two enhancers, or this one that is used in leukemia, they may allow the response to different transcription factor. And so there may be a completely different pathological mechanism that leads to the activation of MYC in these different conditions. And this also indicates that these different regulatory events that leads to MYC expression may be responsive to different type of inhibitory drugs, right? Because if in one case it's regulated through Notch and in the other case it's regulated through, and here I'm just saying names, I don't remember which are the transcription factor involved, but if in one case it's Notch and in the other case it's estrogen receptor, then they would be responding to different drugs and different therapeutical treatment. And I believe that you'll be looking at more cases of enhancer regulation in disease at the end of the course. I think you have a chapter on that. Okay, so whether they are located in one upstream or downstream, what is the general definition of an enhancer? So the enhancer can be defined in two different ways. One way to define it, and the way in which it has been defined from the beginning, is a functional definition. And so it's the one that you can imagine, is the fact that they are regulatory elements that can regulate the transcription of a gene from a distance. So they're not located at the transcription ester site, but they are located far away or somehow far. And the regulation is independent of their orientation. So if you place them in a different location, they can still regulate the transcription. That's how they were defined initially. Now, more often, you find them defined from more of a technical perspective, in the sense that people have started to characterize the enhancer and find chromatin modifications that are particularly enriched on the enhancer, transcription factors that are particularly enriched on enhancer. And so they have used this combination of markers of enhancer in order to define new enhancer. Does that make sense? So in the past, the few enhancer that have been characterized based on function, like the one in Drosophila. Then people started to realize that enhancer have certain specific markers, so they are characterized by binding of certain coactivators, such as P300. They are characterized by specific histone modification, like H3K4 monomethylation, or H3K27 acetylation. And so we start to think about the fact that by looking for those binders or those modifications, we could identify new enhancer. And so this is the approach that it has been used by a lot of labs, by the ENCODE project, in order to define new enhancer based on modification that could be analyzed by ChIP-seq. This has led to identify a large number of new enhancer. It is thought that there may be several hundred up to, some people say even up to 1 million possible enhancer that are active in different cell type at different point. However, one thing that that has to keep in mind is that by defining enhancer in this way, people have not really proven that they are functional. So this large number of possible enhancer, they may be functional or they may be not. At this time, we don't really know. There are a few enhancers that have been well characterized. A lot of the general ideas have been deduced from those and from labeling of other enhancers by the same markers, but we don't know whether those are all functional or not. Okay. Then, with the same approach, there is something that is called the super enhancer. This is something that is very fashionable right now to study super enhancer. They're basically cluster of enhancer that have been found in the genome. So regions where there are not single enhancer, but the regions that are reached in several enhancer placed one after the other. And a number of studies have suggested that these super enhancer are critical in regulating cell lineage determination. And so there are a few hundred of these super enhancers, and the fact that they become activated lead to the activation of large transcriptional programs that are required to establish the differentiation of different cell types from stem cell precursor. So they are very extremely interesting, and that's why they're fashionable. But they're actually not something that is really new, and that's why it's something that has been known to exist in nature for a long time. There is one thing that is called the LCR that has been studied most in the case of the regulation of the beta globin locus. So this has been studied long time ago, and this is a classic super enhancer, even though at that time it was not called the super enhancer. It's a region that is a large regulatory region that was identified as a locus control region because it's a large regulatory region which is highly accessible to a number of transcription factors that regulates the expression of the whole cluster of the globin genes in such a way that they are expressed in a developmental specific manner, so that beta globin is expressed only in the adult erythroid cells and so on and so forth. Now, when people have started to study superenhancer, what they have done is to again look for markers that would label enhancer and then see how they were clustered together and whether they would get to a particular threshold. One thing that superenhancer has been characterized for is also that there is a strong enrichment for MED1. So when people try to define superenhancer, they look not only for the fact that there are a lot of enhancer markers in the same region, but also that there is an enrichment for MED1. And then when they overlap this potential superenhancer with known data, they find, for example, that the newly identified superenhancer do correlate well with the region, such as the LCR and other regions that have been known for a long time to be strong regulatory region in development. Okay, so this is about the organization. Would you want to go ahead? Can I go ahead for a little bit? Do you want to break now? Up to you. Go ahead a little bit. 10 more minutes. Okay, so if you may notice that one of the characteristics of superenhancer is that they are hotspot for transcription factor binding site. And this is not only for superenhancer, this is something that is characteristic of enhancer in general, that they are enriched in transcription factor binding site. And so if you look at the distribution of transcription factor binding site in the genome, you find that they are not dispersed all across the genome as you would expect for a random distribution, but they're actually found clustered in proximity one to the other. And enhancer are particularly enriched in this cluster of transcription factor, which makes sense because if the enhancer is the genomic element where the transcription factor bind in order to regulate transcription, you need to have transcription factor binding site. However, it is worth spending a few minutes discussing about the fact that they come in cluster and that they don't come singularly, because the fact that they come in cluster is actually important to give specificity to transcriptional regulation. And this is because transcription factor binding site that comes in groups allows for a number of things. Allows for combinatorial binding, allows for cooperation between transcription factor, allows for compositional binding. And all these things together are at the basis of the differential gene regulation. So I'll just go quickly through some example of these properties. The first one probably doesn't even need an example. The fact that if there are transcription factor binding sites that comes together, you can have cooperation about transcription factor is obvious, right? So if you had them separated, very far away from each other, then each of them could regulate transcription, but they would not cooperate together. Whereas when they come together, often the presence of two or three of them together doesn't lead to simply the activity of each of them, but will lead to a much higher increase in gene activation. And this has been well studied years ago through a reporter system where people put together different transcription factor binding sites and look at whether transcription increases in a linear manner. And you can see that this example, if you have the single ones, you have just the addition of that particular activity, but then if you put them all together, you get a strong increase in transcriptional activation. And this is because they cooperate. They may be cooperating because they stabilize each other binding, they may be cooperating because they help keeping up keeping open the chromatin. So there may be different reasons for it, but the fact that they are together allows them to work together. The second example is about the combinatorial effect. So this is something that we have already quickly introduced this morning, and is the idea that you can have different combination of factors working together. And if you think about the large number of transcription factors existing, you can have all kind of combinations, and these lead to a high transcriptional regulatory possibilities. And so this is one example. This is an old example from yeast. I don't know if you remember, in yeast there are two mating types, kind of like sex of the yeast. So there is the haploid alpha cells and the haploid, A cells and the alpha cells, or they can have the diploid A and alpha cells. And this is due to the expression of a specific locus, the MET locus. And what the MET locus does is to co-encode for a transcription factor. So it's a clear example of a transcription factor being transcribed and then regulating downstream transcriptional program in a combinatorial manner. So this is possible because they encode for different transcription factor. So the A cell encode for A1, whereas the alpha cells encode for alpha 1 and alpha 2. And they can work either alone or together with another factor that is a constitutive transcription factor. So MCM1 is expressed everywhere. It's not specifically regulated. However, depending on which of the combinations are present, you turn on or off different transcriptional programs. And so if you are in the most complete condition, the diploid cells, where you have both A1 and alpha 2, these can combine in two different ways. They can combine with alpha 2 can combine with MCM1, and this is a repressor, and so it keeps off the alpha A specific genes. The alpha specific genes are off because there is no specific factor that can transcribe them. But then the combination of alpha 2 and A1, which is present only in the diploid cells, because that's the only case in which both locuses, loci, are expressed, leads to the downregulation of the haploid specific genes. This is different in the alpha cells, where instead you want to turn on both the alpha specific as well as the haploid specific. And so these are on because this particular combination doesn't exist. And these are on because now MCM1 can pair with the alpha 1, which is expressed in this particular mating type. And the same thing in the A cell. So this is a classic example of combinatorial effect. Obviously, here we are talking about 4 or 5 transcription factor. The more you increase the number of transcription factors that come together, the higher is the possibility of differential regulation. And then the last example is the compositionality effect. So what this means is that there is an effect, a transcriptional effect that is due to the fact that the different transcription factors that can bind to a regulatory element together with the DNA have to form a complex. It's like almost like a puzzle where all these things come together and bind together. And the composition of these, of the, let's say, the enhancer, so the composition of binding site that is on the enhancer lead to the formation of the whole complex together. And the whole complex together is what regulates transcription. And so this example can illustrate, hopefully, this concept. It's the example of the interferon beta enhancer. The interferon beta enhancer has binding site for a number of different transcription factors, so it's clear example of transcription factor coming together, clustering together on a specific enhancer element. And so there are binding sites for several interferon response factor. There is there are binding sites for NF-kappa B, which is a transcription factor important for regulating inflammatory responses, as well as binding factor for JUN and ATF that together form the AP1 transcription factor. All these have to can bind to specific sequences on DNA. And then there are other proteins that are involved, which are this orange thing. These are not DNA-specific binding factor. They are architectural proteins. So they are they're called HMGs, or they're histone-like. They're architectural proteins that don't bind in a sequence-specific manner. And so what the composition, what they mean by saying composition is that if you look at the binding of all these things alone or together, you realize that only when everything is present, including the architectural protein, you can assemble the so-called enhancosome, so the complete complex that regulates transcription. And to do that, they used an assay that is it's like a variation of the gel shift that we discussed the other day. So it's the same concept. You have the DNA and you add the proteins and you see whether there is retardation. The only difference is that they don't do it with the free probe, but they do it with a chromatinized probe. So they first organize the oligo around the nucleosome so that it's reminiscent of the chromatin environment. And then they use this nucleosome assembled probe in a gel shift experiment. Okay, so the one down here is not free probe, but is free probe are organized around the nucleosome. And then they add all the different components of this potential enhancer alone. And as expected, they can bind DNA. So each one by one, can bind DNA and can retard the migration of this probe. However, only when you also add HMG to the reaction, then all of a sudden you see the formation of this huge enhancosome complex. And this is absolutely dependent on the presence of the architectural protein, because if you use a probe that has been mutated for the HMG binding, then you can see that when everything is present, there is no formation of the enhancosome. And so hopefully this is a it's an example of the fact that you need to you need all the pieces of the puzzle to assemble the whole enhancosome together, and that's an example of composition where the composition of the enhancosome itself allows for specificity in transcriptional regulation. Okay, I think this is a good time to take a break if you like. Thing about the combinatorial activity of transcription factor on enhancer, and then we'll talk a little bit more about how enhancer are selected. So we have looked at the theory of things. We have looked at the fact that transcription factor binding sites come together, allow for this combinatorial effect and cooperation between different transcription factors. But one question that you may ask is, does this really happen in vivo? Do we find all kind of combination? Because the theory is that because you have this very large number of transcription factor, you can combine in millions of different ways, and this allow for differential regulation. But is this really the case, or there are only certain transcription factors that cooperate together? And And so in order to try to understand whether there are rules about the combination, the cooperation between different transcription factors, one can use the data that is available through ENCODE. So we have been talking about ENCODE many times. You know that there are different aspects to it. There is the transcriptional studies that have been done and we discussed during the transcriptomic module. But there is also a lot of data that has been generated to profile transcription factor and cofactors. So in terms of transcription factor, there is a very large number of transcription factor that have been profiled genome-wide by ChIP-seq in five different cell lines. Through more than 500 different experiments. So one way in which you can think of answering that question is to take all this data and look at what it looks like. Where are all these transcription factors binding? Are they binding with specific rules? Are they binding everywhere? What is the situation that you see in vivo in different cells? Okay. And so by doing the profiling of all these transcription factors, the ENCODE project has identified, if I remember correctly, something like 7-8 million binding sites for transcription factors across the genome. And this is the data that I was telling you before led to identify a large number of putative enhancers. I believe the number is something like 400,000, 500,000 potential enhancer, and some people now, current calculations say that it may be higher, it may be go up to 1 million. So what this means is that there are many, many more enhancers than there are promoters, and the question is whether they are all functional, as we discussed before, but we can also look at them to try to... So we cannot differentiate between the functional and the non-functional. This type of analysis look at all enhancers that have been identified. But by looking at all of them, we can try to see whether there are rules in the combination of different transcription factors. And so these are the numbers that I was talking about. So people have this paper, the Gerstein paper, which is again a large publication with data from different people involved in the ENCODE project, led to realize that not all the combination are found in vivo, but there are some rules to it. And so if you take a number of different transcription factor binding site and you look at how they are found the real binding of the transcription factor. If you look at the ChIP-seq data, and so real binding data, and you look at how that correlate to each other in vivo, you find that there are different type of combination, and there are certain combinations that are found very frequently, and other combinations that are almost never observed. And so people have made maps of how different transcription factors cooperate together. And just to show you what the data looks like, this is an example from that paper. This is a complicated figure, but to try to make it a little bit easier to understand, think of this as a very big matrix, okay? And so I made a smaller matrix there. It's just a representation. What this is just a matrix like this, but with many, many more rows and many, many more columns. Okay, on the rows, each line represents one transcription factor, and the binding of across the horizontal axis, you see the binding of that transcription factor to different. Here they are called enhancers, but they are not really enhancers. They are actually peaks. So those are all the peaks that are found in the ChIP-seq data, which may correspond to an answer location. And they are all represented singularly. Okay. The thing is that instead of representing all the binding of all the transcription factor across the genome, each of these maps is made based on a leading transcription factor. So a transcription factor that you are interested in, and then you want to know how that specific transcription factor correlates with the other. And so in this case, the leading transcription factor is this one. In this case, it's GATA1. And so you select the peaks to look at based on GATA1 binding. So you don't look at all genome. You just look at the peaks where GATA binds. And so because those are selected in such a way, for the leading factor, you get a full line because it binds everywhere. And then you look at how the other transcription factor bind in relationship to GATA1. And so you look at whether this transcription factor here binds to the same places or not. You show all the data, and then when you see binding, this is the intensity of the binding depends on how much on the peak intensity. And so if you have a signal here, it indicates that this transcription factor co-binds with your leading factor on that particular peak. And so by doing that, you can reconstitute maps for all transcription factors. So this is done for GATA, but they have done it for all the other transcription factors, where you look at which things come together. And you find that there are transcription factor, I don't remember what this number corresponds to, but let's say the family of transcription factor 7, which binds to certain specific peaks together with GATA. There are other transcription factors, like this cluster 6, that come together with GATA all the time. So those are things that are likely to work in combination with GATA on a regular basis. But there are also things that never come together with GATA. So even though theoretically you could have all the possible combination, in reality you find a cluster of transcription factors that work together. Is this surprising? No, obviously, because those are tissue-specific transcription factors, signal-specific transcription factor. So the program that are co-regulated are likely to be co-regulated by transcription factors that are regulated by the same signals or in the same tissue. You don't want to have all kind of random combination, right? But before this paper, it had not been really assessed in vivo, so this is an interesting observation. Okay, so the last thing that we need to discuss today is an answer selection. If you think about the numbers that we have been talking about, the cells present a very large number of an answer. They may all be functional, only some of them may be functional, but certainly there is a selection process. And so the question is, how are all these interactions that we have looked at, how are they regulated, and how are these transcription factors finding the enhancer that needs to be used at a specific time in development or in response to a specific signal? Okay, and so this is just a study that highlights the complexity of the problem. As I said, we don't know whether all these enhancers are functional, but there are some interesting studies like this one where they have looked at enhancer usage and specific enhancer usage throughout development in mice. And what they have done is to profile for H3K27. So again, as we said before, we are not really looking for the enhancer per se, but we are looking for the mark, for the histone mark that is thought to mark active enhancer. So they use this mark as a surrogate to look for enhancer, and then they use it in order to profile different transgenic mice. You're looking at different mouse tissues across 7 developmental stages. And they identify 90,000 enhancers, so locations that are presented as active enhancers based on the presence of the H3K27 acetylated mark. That seems to be specifically regulated through development. And this is the type of data that they recover. So As you can see, they have probed mice at different stages of development, and then they looked at different tissues. And so what they come up with are maps of this kind, where you can see that they look at enhancers that are located either upstream or downstream of specific genes, and these are genes that are important during development. And they found that each of them is activated at a very, very specific time and in very specific tissue-related way. And so if you look at the first example, SOX11 here, you can see that it's expressed only in the brain region. It's not expressed in the heart, it's not expressed in the liver. And it's expressed in such a way that is off in the very early stages at E11, and then it start to be acetylated, so it potentially start to be coming an active enhancer by E14, and then it's turned off in the adult. A slightly different pattern is the one of this other gene, which is activated at a later time point. And the same for the other, so IGF receptor instead is important in heart development and is the enhancer that regulates. So here we're not looking at the gene that is expressed, but we're looking at whether the enhancer that is upstream or downstream of the gene present the markers of an active enhancer. And so the fact that the marker of an active enhancer are there suggests that the enhancer is active. Functional proof? No. This doesn't mean that they have deleted the enhancer and shown that the genes are not regulated. But I think it's a pretty strong indication and a very interesting study that shows how different enhancers are activated at different time points in development in order to drive the activation of those regulated genes. Okay, so the question is, how are these enhancers selected? How do we go from being an off enhancer to being activated and then turned off again? And how do the transcription factor that have to bind to those enhancer find that specific enhancer at that specific time in development? So in order to address this problem, we can follow how the problem is analyzed and discussed in this review. It's a very, it's a pretty clear review. It goes through the different characteristic of enhancer selection and how enhancer work. So I suggest you read it at some point. I separated some of the topics that are covered in the review between today and tomorrow, so it also covers the idea of enhancer transcription and eRNA. But for today, we'll discuss only about the selection of the different type of enhancer. So the whole idea that is presented in this review and that is emerged from a very large body of work from different labs is that enhancers go through different stages of activation. And so they go from being completely off to being poised for activation to being activated. And so this progression in the activation makes it possible for transcription factor to find them when they become available. And what I mean with this is that you can think of this process in this way. You have regulatory regions that are completely, if you think about the previous example, the SOX enhancer, in the very early stages of development is completely off. And so you have initial stages in which the enhancer is completely off, is chromatinized, is not accessible to transcription factor. Then there are transcription factors that are able to modify this region in such a way that they are prime for activation. So they are labeled in such a way, we'll see what these stars are, they are labeled in such a way that they are not anymore fully silent, but they are partially opened up so that when the tissue-specific or the inducible transcription factor becomes available or becomes activated, then they can recognize this sequence, they can bind to them, and they can activate them. And so if the tissue-specific transcription factor is, for example, estrogen receptor, once estrogen receptor gets activated, it could potentially bind to an answer region everywhere there are transcription factor binding sites. However, because the enhancer are in a silent, closed conformation, those are not available. And so it's going to bind only to the enhancer that have been primed for activation. And so it becomes extremely important, the function of this initial transcription factor that primes only certain enhancer for activation. And so based on this idea, you can define enhancer as either inactive or active, as well as identify some intermediate stages. They could be one or two. There are, depending on how you define this intermediate stage, you can call one prime and the other one poised, or just consider that there is an intermediate stage. And we are really talking about classification rather than the functional importance of it. But what is important to remember is that if you go through these different stages of enhancer activation, you change the accessibility of the enhancer region, you change the histone modification, you change the type of proteins that you find associated with it, even the type of nucleosome that are organized over the enhancer region. And then you have enhancer RNA transcription, and we'll look at that tomorrow. So to look a little bit more into what these stages look like, in the review they present these two models. They look quite complicated, but they're not too bad. The main difference, so the inactive enhancer is obviously closed, so there is not much to say about that. But if you compare a poised or a primed enhancer and an active enhancer, the main there are some major differences. So the first difference is that the poised enhancer starts to be open, so the chromatin conformation begins to change. You start to have a narrow nucleosome-free region, but it's not yet fully, completely open as an active enhancer. Both of them are labeled by H3K4 monomethylation, and so this is an argument for saying that if you use H3K4 monomethyl to identify an enhancer, you identify both enhancers that are not yet fully active, and an enhancer that are already fully active. Whereas if you profile an enhancer for H3K27, you identify only active enhancer, because H3K27 is present once the enhancer becomes fully active and histone acetyltransferases are recruited and phosphorylate H3K27. Whereas in the poised situation, H3K27 is still absent, and actually H3K27 is methylated. And so this is a reason why one way to look at this to different type of different stages of enhancer activation is that these poised enhancers are basically in an intermediate stage where there are both markers of activation and markers of repression. It's kind of like it's still not decided what he wants to become when he grows up. Okay, so he has both. He has repression marks and he has activation marks. If things come along, if the right signal-dependent transcription factor are expressed and they bind and they bring all the associated machinery, then it becomes fully activated and it will lead to transcriptional activation. However, in some condition, it gets turned off again and it's not activated. The other difference between these two conditions is the type of transcription factor that are binding. So if you see here, there is binding of something that is called LDTF. With LDTF, they mean lineage-determining transcription factor. So those are those kind of transcription factor that are expressed through at the beginning of development in order to prime a certain cell type in a, towards a certain lineage. And so it makes perfect sense that those are the transcription factor that will bind to this important enhancer for developmental reason and prime them to be activated at a later stage. Whereas CTS are cooperating transcription factors, so they may be binding with one or the other. Whereas the difference is that once the enhancer becomes active, then you start to recruiting signal-specific transcription factor. Those are the tissue-specific one, like estrogen receptor and others, and those are the one that respond to signal and that gets activated during the final stages of differentiation, for example. Okay? So based on this type of characterization of histone marks that are associated with the different stages of enhancer activation, they show an example of what this looks like if you examine enhancer modification by ChIP-seq in vivo. And they focus on one specific region, no particular reason for that, just it's an example. So they look at the locus of a couple of genes. TAL1, if I remember correctly, is expressed in endothelial cells, whereas it's turned off in it's also expressed in erythroid cells, but it's turned off in other cell types. And so they show what the, this is a gene, so the gene that is expressed is that one up there, TAL1. And then these pink stripes indicate the three regions that are known to be enhancer for TAL1. So there are different enhancers. There is one that is positioned at plus 50 kb, one that is positioned at plus 20 kb, and one that is upstream at minus 4 kb. Okay? And depending on the cell types, you use different enhancer to activate these genes. And so the type of histone modification that you see are different. And so there are situations like this cell type in which the gene is off, and so none of the enhancer is active. There are situations like this one, the first one up here in the embryonic stem cells, where the upstream enhancer is used. And as you can see, it has a very strong labeling with H3K27 methylation. So that's a case where the enhancer is primed, but is not active yet. If you look at the colors, green is H3K27 methylation, whereas orange is H3K27 acetylation. So if this enhancer was active, then you wouldn't see any methylation of H3K27, but you would see orange, okay? And so that particular condition in embryonic stem cells, it means that the enhancer is fully primed, which makes sense because those are embryonic stem cells, so the enhancer is primed to be used, but it's not active yet. However, if you look in cell types where that enhancer is used, which are the minus 4 kb is used in endothelial cells, so UVEC, for example, up here, you see that you start seeing orange as well as pink because you also start to see some H3K4 dimethylation. The pink indicates whether the DNA is accessible or not, and so that goes together with the priming of the enhancer because it starts to be open. Okay, so this is just one example to see how people differentiate between enhancer poised and enhancer active in vivo in ChIP-seq data. Now, the last thing that I want to discuss is how are those initial transcription factors recognizing the enhancer, and how do they go about opening up the chromatin. So the situation in which that we have described just now is one where the enhancer can be completely turned off, and then you have partial activation, the enhancer becomes poised, and then it gets fully activated. This stage is not necessarily happen. You can also have situation in which you go directly from compact chromatin to open chromatin, and the enhancer gets fully activated. However, in both situations, you have the fact that there must be transcription factor that binds to the DNA in this closed conformation and then start the opening of the chromatin. And in these are the factors that are called lineage determining as well as associated factors. And in order to be able to bind in this condition, if you remember what we discussed this morning, these are likely to be pioneer transcription factor, right? Because those are the ones that can bind to DNA even though the chromatin is in a closed conformation. And we have discussed them this morning. They can interact with DNA even when it's tightly bound. And the binding of them to the chromatin is thought to be the first event that leads to the initial opening of the chromatin and the establishment of this poised bivalent state in which the enhancer can be activated if the situation proceed as it should. So to give you a few examples of what these pioneer factors are, one of them, you may remember it from this morning, is PU1. So when we looked at the at how to study cooperation between transcription factors by using ChIP-seq data, we look at one paper in which they studied PU1 binding during the differentiation of the hematopoietic system. And we saw that it's important for the development of both the macrophages lineages as well as the B cell lineage. And then we looked at the fact that in those two conditions, it associates with different cooperating transcription factors. Now, PU1 is exactly an example of what we just discussed. It is one of those pioneer binding factor that is expressed early on during the early phases of differentiation. So if we are thinking about the hematopoietic system, it's expressed in the early precursor. And then the expression of PU1 leads to PU1 binding in different regions. The interesting thing is that PU1 will bind to different enhancer in the two lineage pathways. And so in the pathways that will lead to B cell development, it will bind to certain enhancer, whereas in the pathways that lead to macrophage development, it will bind to a different set of enhancer. Then it will do what we have just discussed. It will recruit chromatin remodeling enzymes that will start opening the chromatin, lead to H3K4 monomethylation, and so create this poised enhancer that then can be bound by tissue-specific transcription factor. Now, if you look at what these tissue-specific transcription factors are, you will see that they are different for B cells and for macrophages. And the fact that PU1 has differentially primed this enhancer early on will lead to the expression, the use of different enhancer during the differentiation process, and therefore the binding of different cooperating factor that will support the differentiation in the two different lineages. Another example of a pioneer factor that regulates enhancer activation is FOXA1. FOXA1 is probably one of the prototypical pioneer factor that regulates enhancer. It was discovered when people started to look at the binding of estrogen receptor genome-wide. So these are a couple of papers that came out one after the other where this group decided to look at where estrogen receptor was binding genome-wide. So they did ChIP-seq for estrogen receptor. And the first thing they found was that, that at that time was surprising, was that estrogen receptor mostly bind to distal regulatory region. until then, it was thought that estrogen receptor was mostly binding to promoters. And if you think about the kinetic experiment that we saw at the beginning, those were done looking at the promoter of the PS2 gene. And because of those examples, people thought that estrogen receptor would bind to promoter areas. However, when we started to do genome-wide analysis, it became clear that estrogen receptor, just like many other signal-dependent transcription factor, binds mostly to distal regulatory region, which makes sense now that we know of an answer and of all these regulatory conditions. The other thing that they found is that estrogen binding seemed to be dependent on the presence of binding site for a factor called FOXA1. And so what they did was to characterize the binding of estrogen receptor and FOXA1 together, and they found that they often associate, so these are ChIP-seq data where you see the binding of estrogen receptor and the correlation with the binding of FOXA1, and you can see that they all always come together. It's a pretty strong correlation compared to what is observed for other transcription factors. And then they try to see whether one depending on the other. And so they remove FOXA1 by using an siRNA against FOXA1, and then looked at the binding of estrogen receptor in presence of FOXA. So first they look at the binding of FOXA1, and they see that they lose the binding of FOXA1. And then they look at how the binding of estrogen receptor changes when FOXA1 is not there. And you see that you actually lose the majority of estrogen receptor binding if FOXA1 is not there. And so if you think of this result in the context of what we have just discussed, this is a pretty nice example of the activity of a pioneer transcription factor, in this case FOXA1, that can bind to selected promoters and make them accessible to estrogen receptor. If FOXA1 is not there, estrogen receptor binding is dramatically decreased. Okay, so this is more of the textbook description of how this works. One thing that one should consider, though, is how this fits into the idea that we discussed at the beginning of the class today of how dynamic things are. And so one paper, for example, that look at the relationship between FOXA1 binding and estrogen receptor binding from a more dynamic perspective suggests that it's also true the opposite. So what they say is that, yes, it is true. All those data suggest that FOXA1 is a pioneer for estrogen receptor. However, if we do single molecule tracking experiment in live cells, so the type of experiment that we discussed at the beginning where you look at the live imaging association of the receptor to the DNA, and you, or the FOXA1 to the DNA, and you do that in a situation in which you, instead of deleting FOXA1, you delete the estrogen receptor, you find that there are some genomic sites where removing estrogen receptors seem to be affecting FOXA1 recruitment. So this is not to say that what we just discussed is not true, but is to say that, again, just as we discussed at the beginning of the day, the situation is much more dynamic. And so this is the type of fixed model that we have been discussed now, one where you have this hierarchical recruitment of factors, right? So the first one is the pioneer factor. It recognized the DNA. It induce the labeling of the histone with certain marks, the chromatin gets opened, and then the other transcription, the nucleosome are displaced, and then the other transcription factor can bind. This is a hierarchical sequential binding of transcription factor in a very fixed and static model in which when one of the events happen, then it's there. So you... the announcer becomes poised and it stays poised. You have to consider this in the context of the dynamics, the fast dynamics of protein interaction with DNA that we discussed earlier. And so if you think of them in that way, you can imagine more of a dynamic view of transcriptional regulation and regulation of enhancer, where all these things should be seen as a frequency of events rather than events that happen and then they are stable. And so also the recruitment of pioneer factors versus signal-specific transcription factor is probably not such a sequential thing where you recruit the pioneer first, the pioneer open. It's more of a thing that if there is enough pioneer binding to DNA, there is enough frequency of changes in the chromatin conformation, and therefore the binding on and off of the transcription factor can more easily happen. And so, those are two different views that one has to consider. They are not exclusive of each other. The hierarchical models, I think, help us understand how things happen, and so we tend to create this model and draw them in this way where things happen one after the other, because it makes it easier for us to understand the correlation. And also because often the way in which we do the experiment lead to understand them in that way, because if the experiment is done in such a way in which we downregulate a certain factor by siRNA or by knockout, by CRISPR, whatever, and then we look at the effect, that knockout removes the factor completely. And so the fact that the things that happen after are not seen, sure, it makes sense that that specific event has to happen first, but it doesn't mean that it happens once and then it doesn't revert back. So I think this is the message for today. Transcriptional regulation is a complicated story. It's probably much more complicated than we make it. There are some rules about the activation of the enhancer, but nothing is written in stone, and things are pretty dynamic. And that's it. So tomorrow we'll look at what happens once the enhancer are activated. Any questions? No.